Live from New York, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. Today, an in-depth original investigative report on the safety of cell phones, cell towers, and other electromagnetic instruments or appliances. This is in relationship to a recent article in the New York Times that was reporting on the CDC, originally saying cell phones could pose a problem, and then retracting that shortly thereafter. Well, what caused that retraction? The Times didn't give us the details. Also, the Times was not challenging the safety of cell phones. Had they done their own independent research, I believe that the article would have been much different. Therefore, I wrote the article that I believe you need to see, fully referenced. It'll be posted today on our website so you can download it. Also today, the latest, of course, on health and healing. We're going to look at the question about the omega-3 fatty acids. Which ones are the best? Well, we have that information now from a new study, and I'll share that with you. Also, from the Salk Institute, new research on your brain's capacity. You know that statement that we hear that, well, you know, we only use 5% of our brains, but Einstein used 10? No, that's not true. We use 100% of our brain. However, our brain's capacity is a lot different than previously thought. Then we'll talk about looking at eating healthier fats can definitely reduce heart disease and deaths worldwide from the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition. And we'll also take a look at marijuana reducing Alzheimer's symptoms, the latest study from the peer-reviewed journal, the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. So we have a lot to share, including the latest information from a major peer-reviewed journal that no one's reporting on the chickenpox and shingles vaccine can cause a serious problem. I'll tell you what that is. So let's begin. First off, I believe that medical marijuana, especially that which has been extracted from the oil and hence is concentrated and measurable, is important for brain cancers, for seizures, for Alzheimer's, for multiple sclerosis, and other conditions, very much the neurological conditions, but also cancers. And especially if someone is trying an alternative therapy, that should be at the top of their list. It has to be medically and supervised, but there are more than enough science showing that it works. This is from the latest from Alternet. The administration of liquid cannabis extracts containing THC is associated with the mitigation of various symptoms of Alzheimer's-related agitation and dementia, according to an observational trial data published online on the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. Israeli investigators assessed the use of cannabis oil as an adjunct pharmacotherapeutic treatment in Alzheimer's patients over a period of several weeks. The researchers reported that drug administration was associated with a significant reduction in patients' symptoms severity scores. Specifically, cannabis oil ingested and was then measured, and it decreased aggression, irritability, apathy, and delusions. So, quote, adding medical cannabis oil to Alzheimer's disease patients' pharmacotherapy is safe and a promising treatment. So that's good. Now, one big thing in America is we love to eat fatty foods. Okay, well, are they healthy fats or non-healthy fats? According to Tufts University School of Nutritional Science, and published in the Journal of the American Heart Association, eating healthier fats could save more than 1 million people internationally from dying from heart disease, and the types of diet changes needed differ greatly between countries. Quote, worldwide policymakers are focusing on reducing saturated fats, yet we found there could be a much bigger impact on heart disease deaths if the priority was to increase the consumption of polyunsaturated fats as a replacement for saturated fats from refined carbohydrates, as well as to reduce trans fats. That's according to the MD, PhD, senior researcher and dean of the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science. So, in lay language, what does this mean? It means that some people are on a very low-fat diet, I believe lower than what is healthy. The Pritikin program, and I knew Nathan Pritikin. I had him on the program. We debated several times. And he believed that you should have no more than 10% of your total calories and fat. However, he was very unhealthy, and he died. And that was a long time ago. But if you are on a low-fat diet for a period of time, there's a high loss of weight, which is good, but doing it in an unhealthy way is not. And so the initial clamor was, oh, I lost that amount of weight, this amount of weight. Yeah, well, starving can also do the same thing. The key is you can be a vegan and eat pizzas, or you can be a vegan and eat nuts and seeds. You can be a healthy vegan, unhealthy vegan. So it's a matter of the healthy choices of fat here. When traveling throughout the world, you will see people who have very, very low incidences of heart disease as compared to those in this country and as a percentage of their population. And that's because they're primarily eating from the oils a monounsaturated fatty acid. That would be olive oil. And worldwide, olive oil, apricot oil, avocado oil, sesame seed oil, these are some of the healthiest oils, along with coconut oil. But, and coconut oil is a fatty, a saturated fat. But the bad oils are going to be the oils such as your trans fats, cottonseed oil, and the canola oil. You don't want to have those in your diet. So that's what it's saying. And we could save at least 1 million people a year. Easier to do in the Mediterranean area because they don't have a big transition. They're already eating healthy. More difficult in the United States. From the Salk Institute, they say the following, quote, Salk researchers and collaborators have achieved critical insight into the size of neural connections, putting the memory capacity of the brain far higher than common estimates. The new work also answers a long-standing question as to how the brain is so energy efficient and could help engineers build computers that are incredibly powerful but also conserve energy. This is a real bombshell in the field of neuroscience, Salk professor and senior author of the paper that was published in eLife. We discovered the key to unlocking the design principle of how hippocampal neurons function with low energy but high computation power. Our new measurements of the brain's memory capacity increase conservative estimates by a factor of 10. Wow. Wow. That's 1,000%. So, for those of you who thought that, you know, we didn't have a capacity beyond a capacity, or there's just this common assumption, well, you're older, more difficult remembering, more difficult learning, take it easy. So in those society, including our own now, but not historically, historically in America, as in many other nations, you never really stop working. You never stop being a person who was important in the family or societal structure, unless you were made infirm by some reason. And then, as long as you were critical in your thinking, you were still able to think and communicate, you still held that position of the wise man or wise woman. What has happened recently is we've encouraged everybody to take it easy. And so everyone is. Not everyone, but a lot. As a result, the new science says, you just had surgery, you know, on a leg that was broken, to reconnect it, get up the next day, or even the same day. Historically, they might have you in bed for a week or two before they got you out of bed. Historically, we always thought that because a person was older, that everything has to slow down. It's not true. If a person slows down, it may be because of conditioning or no longer feeling relevant or bored with life or no longer interested, but it doesn't mean you can't. Keep going. Now we know your brain can do a lot. It has an enormous capacity that is yet to be fully appreciated. So, problem solving, starting new projects, starting life over, learning things from scratch, beginning your learning curve, you have the capacity in your brain to do it. Now, to their question about energy, if you want to see something they don't know about, didn't test, try coenzyme Q10, ubiquinol, and NADH, maybe 20 milligrams of NADH, and 200 to 300 milligrams spread out, 100 three times a day of ubiquinol or coenzyme Q10. With ginkgo biloba, 100 milligrams, maybe three times a day. And the active ingredients in green tea. And there's a lot of ways that we can activate our cytokines and to turn off inflammation in the brain. And then take the EGCG. EGCG are the gallates, and I would say 300 to 800 milligrams. When you do that, wow. And something else that can help the brain is to take magnesium L-threonate, T-H-R-E-O-N-A-T-E, 3-O-N-A-T-E, and maybe 100, 200 milligrams. That can help enhance memory and help enhance cognitive function. Regular magnesium will not pass the blood-brain barrier like that. This does. But it takes a lot of complex magnesium to get that. In other words, you'd have to use, well, a formulator would have to use about 2,000 milligrams of gross macro magnesium to get the micro amount, like 140, 150 milligrams that could be absorbed into the brain, and suddenly your whole brain starts to light up. You start to lift that brain fog. I've seen people where I've worked with who have depression. Suddenly they call and say, wow, what happened? What do you mean? I woke up and it was like someone opened the window, the breeze came in, the light came in, I feel great. Well, now your brain has been energized. But when you take the Coca-Colas or the sugars or the soft drinks, you're not going to have the same impact. Also, chicken pox. When I grew up, and many of you, I'm sure, we got chicken pox. No one died from it. It was uncomfortable. Our moms would put different lotions on it and sometimes give us a cold bath, and we got over it. And some families actually brought the kids in the neighborhood together to give them a chicken pox party. We created natural immunity. We're immune for life. We won't have another case of chicken pox. But science, believing they're right, said, no, 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 don't trust nature, don't trust your body, trust us. Okay, we're going to create a chickenpox vaccine and a shingles vaccine. Well, doesn't shingles come from chickenpox? Yes, but we're still going to give you a vaccine. Are they safe? Of course they're safe. You sure? Of course we're sure. We're scientists and we're doctors. I see. So then I can combine the two and say, medical science, yes. Well, then what about the University of Missouri at Columbia? What about our primary care physicians are unaware that when you give a chickenpox and shingle vaccine today, the side effects could be inflammation in the cornea of our eye? Quote, in use for more than 20 years, the Varicella Zoster virus vaccine for chickenpox and shingles is considered an essential medicine by the World Health Organization, However, researchers from the University of Missouri School of Medicine have found in rare instances a link between the vaccine and inflammation in the cornea. It is a finding the researchers say should be discussed by primary care physicians and patients. You bet. Well, that means for 20 years, people were getting inflammation in the eye after the vaccine. Doc says it has nothing to do with the vaccine. Yeah, it did. And now you know about it. Also today, I want to focus upon eating in order to slow down the aging of your heart. And if you understand how you can slow down the heart aging, it is by the following. I'm going to make it real simple. You got to have some spicy foods in there. Good quality cayenne pepper, red chili peppers, jalapeno peppers, great for you. Also, make sure you get a variety of berries. The best berry for the heart and the epithelium, pomegranate. A pint of pomegranate fresh berries, good. About 3 tablespoons of pomegranate concentrate, phenomenal. Also, tart cherry concentrate, that's good for the heart. Then the foods at the top of the list would be your green vegetables. All green vegetables are good for the heart. Beans are good for the heart. And nuts in particular are your superstars for the heart. Of all the nuts good for the heart, I would put walnuts, pistachios, and macadamias in that order for your heart. And that means you could have the nuts. I'm not talking about toasted, salted. I'm talking about raw and organic. And then the nutrients for the heart to slow it down and have it live longer. Coenzyme Q10, that's your number one superstar. Vitamin C, that's number two. Vitamin E with tocotrienols, that would be number three. Magnesium, right up there with them. Potassium, along with magnesium. Calcium, but less than about half the amount of magnesium for the heart. And hawthorn, to keep your heart beating regularly. And ginkgo biloba, which also stabilizes a regular heartbeat. So those are the things. There are others, but I'm talking about ones that are relatively easy, inexpensive, and doable. And by the way, the latest study on measuring all the different types of omega-3 fatty acids to see which one's best, well, they're all good. This is from NutriScience. It says, omega-3s may have been created unequal, but all varieties, plant-based, marine, and algae sources have a potential role in supporting health. And, quote, I go to a lot of fish oil meetings talking about plant sources. I never say either or. I always say and. I feel very strongly that the whole family of omega-3s is critical for good nutrition. And that's one of the leading experts on the fatty acids. The key is this. You want at the end of it, no matter what the source, eating avocados, having a handful of walnuts, some flax seeds, you want what is called EPA and DHA. Both are essential. And both of those are what help the heart. So as long as you're getting that, then you are getting that, by the way, from flax and from vegetarian sources and even algaes. So you're doing the right thing. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break and come back. Please stay with us.
Too much of anything is not good for you, baby. But I don't know about that. As many times as we loved and we've shared love and made love, it doesn't seem to me like it's enough. It's just not enough, baby. It's just not enough.
Oh, oh, baby.
Lovely.
My darling, I can't get enough of your love, baby. Girl, I don't know why.
I'd like to welcome you from all over the world. When you go to our website today, you'll see arrows going to all the different countries. We are heard in almost every country in the world every day. If you Google Progressive Radio, we're number one in the world. If you Google Liberal Radio, we're number one. And the numbers are phenomenal. Now, on my personal Facebook page, it shows the number of people coming in each week. And a lot of these are new people. Thus far this week is around 1.8 million. Just this week. So it's a whole lot of people wanting health and the information in the articles. And that's why we post so many important articles that can help empower people. Now I want to share something with you that is important. I see this a lot when I read an article, and I see that either they have missed the importance, the essence of what should have been shared, or they may be complicit. I don't know their motives, so I'm not going to ascribe anything on that level. But what I want to do is I want to let you know that the New York Times, in my personal opinion, could have done a lot better job than what was done on that issue. And that was on cell phones. I want to share something now with you. This is entitled Radiating Corruption, The Frightening Science and Politics of Cell Phone Safety. It is posted on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. An article published in the New York Times 2 weeks ago entitled At CDC, A Debate Behind Recommendations on Cell Phone Risk. The author discusses the controversy surrounding the potential health risks of using cell phones. He writes that 18 months ago, the CDC issued guidelines recommending, quote, caution in cell phone use due to the potentially harmful effects of radiation emitted by the wireless devices on human health. Included in the guidelines was information about reducing exposure among children. Well, just a few weeks after the CDC's publication and amid rising concerns about cell phone safety, the CDC rescinded the advisory completely. Today, the CDC's website takes an ambiguous stance on the issue, stating, quote, can using a cell phone cause cancer? There is no scientific evidence that provides a definitive answer to that question. Some organizations recommend caution cell phone use. More research is needed before we know if using cell phones causes health effects, end quote. The reporter for the New York Times notes several agencies and individuals which have drawn stronger conclusions on the potential risk of such radiation. Among them is the International Agency for Research on Cancer, a branch of the World Health Organization, which listed the radio frequencies emitted by cell phones as, quote, a possible carcinogen. That was way back in 2011. It is mentioned in the article that health authorities in several countries, including Finland and the United Kingdom and Israel, have issued warnings to their citizens about the potential hazards of non-ionizing radiation from cell phones. Now, as one of the foremost organizations tasked with ensuring the health and safety of Americans, it is troubling that the CDC has failed to warn us of the potential dangers of these devices. We find that even a cursory review of the scientific literature reveals a significant body of research that points to the harmful effects of cell phone radiation. Let me share you what the CDC has not. First, the health issues in children. According to research, radiation from cell phones is more easily absorbed by children than adults. Sources, moldable. For example, page 3681 to 895 in Physiology, Medical, and Biology, volume 53. Bioelectronic Magnetics, volume 29, page 133. And these are all independent, separate articles on the same issue of health and children. The Transactions for Microwave Theory and Techniques, Volume 51. The Microwave Theory and Techniques, Volume 44. Separately, a Danish study surveyed more than 13,000 children, finding 80% increase in the likelihood of behavioral problems among children who use cell phones and whose mothers use cell phones during pregnancy. Just one source, Epidemiology, Volume 19. Then there's the issue of cancers or tumors from cell phone use. Research indicates that long-term cell phone users run a significantly elevated risk of developing glioma. The glioma is a brain tumor that is often cancerous. The findings reflect that tumors usually appear on the side of the head, favoring cell phone conversation use. How many different studies? Multiple ones. I'll just give you a few. The International Journal of Cancer, Volume 120, and the Revelations in Epidemiology, Volume 55. Then there's the long-term exposure to cell phone radiation is linked to a 60% higher risk of developing a condition known as acoustic neuroma, which is a benign brain tumor. Again, multiple scientific independent studies, including pathophysiology. Then we also have the Environmental Health Perspectives, Volume 117. Then look at heavy cell phone use increases the risk of benign salivary gland tumors by 60%. Source of that, the American Journal of Epidemiology, Volume 167. Then we have radiation from cell phone produces reactive oxygen species, which may contribute to DNA damage, resulting in inflammatory conditions such as cancer and heart disease. Sources, Pathophysiology, Volume 16, Pharmacology Review, Volume 60. Then we have brain cancer risk tripled among individuals who use cell phones for more than 15 hours monthly, and that is Occupational and Environmental Medicine, Volume 72. Then we have cell phone use and infertility. The close proximity of cell phones carried in pant pockets to reproductive organs have led many to suspect a link between radiation from the device and infertility. Several studies point to the damaging effects of cell phone radiation on sperm and lowering sperm quality in men who carried their cell phones in their pants pocket when compared to men who carried cell phones outside of that. And biological literature is one, and also a separate study on higher cell phone use linked with lower sperm quality in the Archives of Androgyny, Volume 51, and cell phone use associated with decreased sperm mobility or motility, the Journal of Urology, Volume 19. And then we have the area of men who use cell phones for more than 4 hours daily found to have lower sperm quality by 42%, and that was infertility and sterility. And anyhow, there's at least 9, including cell erectile dysfunction. How many men knew that if you wear, if you have your cell phone in your pocket, you can end up having erectile dysfunction? But there's an article on that in the Central European Journal of Urology, Volume 66. And then we have the brain neurological health. Electromagnetic frequencies from cell phones alter brain tissue activity by increasing glucose metabolism. You can review that in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Volume 305. And then Yale University researchers showed that mice exposed to cell phone radio frequencies in utero exhibited impaired memory and hyperactivity. And that is in Science Reproduction. Then you have 30 minutes of cell phone use causes spontaneous low-frequency fluctuations in the brain, and that is in Clinical Neurophysiology. And cell phone use may interfere with brain sleep patterns, and that is in a PMID journal. And exposure to electromagnetic cell phone frequency damages fetal brains in rats, and this is the PMID. So those are just some. I have a lot more. So why is the CDC, an institution with more than enough resources to thoroughly investigate such issues, why are they failed to take into account the preponderance of evidence suggesting a link between cell phone use and health problems? And how can we explain the CDC's quick retraction of their guidelines using the article from the New York Times? They gave us none. Now let me tell you the real story. An investigative report published by the watchdog group Environmental Health Trust digs deeper into the circumstances surrounding the CDC's retraction of their guidelines on cell phone radiation exposure. The report, based on 500 pages of internal CDC documents released through the Freedom of Information Act, illustrates key information left out of the New York Times article and points to a cover-up by the CDC. Among the most startling revelations detailed is that immediately after publishing the new guidelines in June of 2014, the CDC hired Kenneth Foster as a consultant to assist in the creation of future materials related to, quote, non-ionizing radiation matters. It just so happens that Foster has an established record of conducting research funded by the wireless industry and has authored a number of studies with results that appear to contradict the notion that children are more susceptible to cell phone radiation than adults. One such study, published by Foster, was recently scrutinized by senior medical advisor Robert Morris, MD, PhD, and his peers in a paper published in the journal IEEE. In the paper, the authors highlight the dubious and unscientific methodology used by Foster and his colleagues in drawing their conclusions about children absorbing cell phone waves, pointing out, quote, what appears to be a deliberate distortion of the science and a bold-faced effort to downplay potential risks to children using mobile devices, end quote. Also unearthed in the investigation were internal communications between the CDC staff showing that the agency considered including in their guidelines information about the potential hazards of cell phone towers located near schools, but chose to omit that information. By all indications, CDC officials aren't immune to the influence of the cell phone industry, even when the health of American children is at stake. The role of special interests in shaping government policy on wireless devices seems to extend beyond the CDC. An expose by the Environmental Working Group released in 2013 documented a disturbingly similar case of our regulatory agencies buckling under pressure from the industry. The controversy began after the FCC, presumably in response to research demonstrating the dangers of cell phone radio waves, updated their website in November 2009 to recommend that people, quote, buy a wireless device with lower SAR, end quote, referring to, that's cell phones which emit less radiation. Reviewing a Federal Communications Commission's documents secured under the Freedom of Information Act, the working group discovered that over the next 9 months, three meetings were held between FCC staff and wireless companies such as Nokia, AT&T, Motorola, as well as Cellular Telecommunications Industry Association, which lobbies on behalf of all cell phone giants, including Verizon, Sprint, T-Mobile, and Cricket. The topic of discussion at the meetings revolved around the issue of specific absorption rate, or SAR, a measurement of how much radiation the body absorbs from wireless devices. And in September 2010, less than 1 year after the cautionary advice was first posted on the FCC website, the agency revised the language on its website, adopting a dramatically different position on the issue, and then it watered it down. And once again, it appears that our bureaucratic institutions prefer to submit to the whims of corporate lobbyists rather than protect citizens from scientifically established health hazards. Now, closer examination of the FCC turns up the further evidence of a revolving door between the organization and the telecommunications industry. A prime example of the conflicts of interest within the organization could be found in the current president and CEO of the cell phone industry trade group, Meredith Atwell Baker. Baker served as a commissioner for the FCC from 2009 to 2011, and before that worked for the trade agency as director of congressional affairs from 1998 to 2000. And remarkably, while he acted as, or she acted as, the FCC commissioner, she voted in favor of Comcast acquiring NBC Universal and left the agency just 5 months later and became Comcast NBC Universal's senior vice president of government affairs. Baker's long history of hopping the fence between industry insider and government regulator raises questions about her loyalties. And Baker isn't an isolated case. The current chairman heading the FCC, Tom Wheeler, previously worked as the president of the influential lobby group known as National Cable and Telecommunication Association and served as its CEO of its largest trade group. And in a stunning role reversal, former FCC chairman Michael Powell is now president and CEO of the largest cell phone trade group. So this is what was left out of the New York Times. And I believe that is essential that we know. Now, that's only part of the story. The full story you can read. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. And now to the public health segment of our program. We're going to look at the issue about giving antipsychotic drugs to infants and toddlers and young children. The question is, why would we? There is absolutely no science to support that this is a beneficial or even a safe thing to do. To learn the truth, we're going to look at Dr. Gary Kohls, K-O-H-L-S, who's written an article published on the Progressive Radio Network on this very topic. When physicians or medical paraprofessionals prescribe psychiatric drugs to children without the parent or legal guardian's fully informed consent, the prescribers could reasonably be charged with reckless endangerment or child endangerment because such drugs commonly cause a multitude of well-known adverse effects, including worsening depression, worsening anxiety, sleep disturbances, suicidality, homicidality, mania, psychosis, heart problems, growth disturbances, malnutrition, cognitive disabilities, dementia, microbiological disorders of the intestine, strokes, diabetes, serious withdrawal effects, death, sudden death, and, well, as you see. And physicians normally only spend a small amount of their scarce time warning patients about the dozens of potential adverse effects when recommending drug treatment. And apparently, most American courts uphold this questionable action when the rare malpractice case manages to be heard in the legal system. And yet, Child Protective Services has the legal right to charge parents with medical neglect for refusing to give their child a known neurotoxic or psychotoxic drug that was not adequately tested either in the animal lab or in the long-term clinical human trials prior to being given to the market for FDA approval. So this makes no sense to parents and can't be explained by their lawyers, especially if the parents know more than their medical caregivers about the multitude of potentially serious dangers that such drugs could pose for their child. Now, it's worth noting that psychiatrists admit that there is no scientific test in existence that proves that children deserve a permanent mental disorder label. And indeed, making a psychiatrist diagnosis in this big business era of high volume, high turnover patients care can be based almost always on unscientific, sometimes absurd checklist of patient behavior and emotions or thoughts, often hurriedly obtained after a relatively short office visit. Checklists of signs or symptoms of a newly thought up or made it out of whole cloth mental illness that does not exist in reality periodically are composed at the annual meeting of the American Psychiatric Association where the newly invented disorder is voted on. Trust me, this is true. They simply show hands in the air by groups of volunteer psychiatrists, most of whom have financial or professional conflicts of interest, and if a sufficient majority of convention attendees agree, the new diagnosis is then placed in the next diagnostic and statistical manual, which contains hundreds of other unscientific, absurd checklists of so-called mental disorders. It's all just a fool's errand. However, there is another part to this sad story, and that is ignoring the warnings of drug regulatory agencies. Psychiatrists have long admitted that none of their drugs ever cure anything or anyone. They also admit that there are no medical, laboratory, radiological, or biopsy tests to confirm that any given psychiatric diagnosis is actually a medical condition. I mean, look at it this way. You have a heart attack, your cardiologist can show you, here's your heart, here's the damage, here's the blockage. If you have a stroke, they can do the same. If you have cancer, they can show you the cancer and whether it's localized or metastasized. If you have diabetes, they can show this to you in your blood sugar. If you have arthritis, they can show you the calcification. They can show you the wear and tear. And yet, when it comes to psychiatric disorders, they can show you nothing because there is no basis in science for these diagnoses, not one. There are, however, thousands of laboratory radiobiology and bioassay assays that confirm the existence of long-term neurotoxic effects of the multitude of synthetic psychoactive drugs that continue to be given out in combinations that have never been adequately tested for efficacy or safety, even in the animal labs. Therefore, what the courts have erroneously criminalized as parental neglect must be reassessed by the legal system. The parent that refuses potentially hazardous psychiatric drugs for their child because they happen to know more about the drug's dangers than their prescriber should be supported, not punished, by the courts and lawyers and judges interested in understanding the nature of the best neuroscience need to be increasingly mistrustful of psychiatric so-called experts who frequently have serious conflicts of interest when it comes to maintaining the prestige or economics of the big business of pharmaceuticals, medicine, psychiatry. There have been more than 200 international drug regulatory agency warnings about the fact that psychiatric drugs can cause dangerous and potentially life-threatening effects. And yet, the so-called basic science-based warnings about the dangers of prescription drugs are easily available for anyone concerned with the health and welfare of our children's brains and bodies, and parents are always more concerned in all cases than their doctors. Concerned parents should be cautious about allowing their vulnerable children to be given potentially toxic substances, especially when the drugs are being prescribed off-label, meaning for indications that are not approved by the FDA. And this is a big issue. Now, let me just focus for a moment on this, reckless endangerment, because reckless endangerment is a crime consisting of an act that created a substantial risk of serious physical injury to another person, even if the accused person did not intend to harm the victim. However, the person must have acted in a way that showed a disregard for the foreseeable consequences of the actions. The charge may occur in various contexts, such as domestic cases or car accidents or construction site accidents or testing sites or domestic child abuse situations, hospital abuse, and the penalties vary from state to state. While child endangerment refers to an act or omission that places a child at risk of physiological, emotional, or psychological abuse, child abuse based on the offense of child endangerment is normally a misdemeanor. But endangerment that results in mental illness or serious physical illness or injury is a felony. The child who is subjected to child endangerment is called an abused child or a neglected child. This means that an action or failure to act on the part of a parent or caretaker or health giver that results in death or serious physical or emotional harm or sexual abuse or exploitation or an act or failure to act that presents an imminent risk of serious harm could result in legal action. So, infants and small children are most at risk because they commonly get multiple doses of vaccines at a single well baby visit at 2, 4, and 6 months of age when their immune systems and blood-brain barriers are at their most immature and their body's weight is at its smallest. Thus, our smallest pediatric patients are much more at risk of developing, and sometimes in a delayed fashion, autoimmune and neurotoxic disorders that I talked about all the time on this program. Astonishingly, deaths or damage because of vaccine injury cannot be litigated in the United States because of the 1986 Reagan-era law that absolves multinational vaccine corporations' liability. So, the sobering data has been gleaned from all the scientific literature that shows that antipsychotic drugs equal, in my personal opinion, reckless child endangerment. And let me give you an understanding why. You take a three-month-old receiving a psychiatric medication, and it's an antipsychotic. Show me the scientific evidence that any three-year-old in the United States suffers from that. They don't. So it's time that we said no more antipsychotic drugs to any children in the United States for any reason. Now, to conclude our program today, we're going to show you a brief history. There'll be more to come in the future on the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is an extraordinarily dangerous institution, and we have been exploited by it. Here is a brief 7-minute history.
We need to go back to the early 1900s. 1910, to be exact. Everyone at some point in their lives has heard of the Federal Reserve, but most likely don't understand what it is or how it works. The Federal Reserve, referred to as the Fed, is a central bank that many economists refer to as the biggest robbery ever enacted on the American people. The reason for this is because the Federal Reserve is neither part of the federal government, nor does it have any reserves. Yet, this single organization controls the money supply of the most powerful country in the world. The Fed is very diligent in hiding the fact that they are not part of the government. The last thing they want the American people to fully understand is that our government does not control our own money. In order to achieve this, they were very clever and decided to call their institution the Federal Reserve. And by labeling themselves this way, the general public never thought twice about who was in control of the country's money supply. If the Federal Reserve is not part of the government, then who controls this private organization and how did this come to be? The answer to this question is what changed the course of our country forever. In November of 1910, a secret meeting took place of six bankers and economic policymakers who represented the financial elite of the Western world. It was hosted at the J.P. Morgan Estate on Jekyll Island in Georgia. In attendance was Senator Nelson W. Aldrich, Abram Pyatt Andrew Jr., Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, Frank Vanderlip, President of National City Bank of New York, Henry P. Davidson, Senior Partner of J.P. Morgan & Company, Charles D. Norton, President of First National Bank of New York, Paul Warburg, Director of Wells Fargo, Benjamin Strong, the emissary for J.P. Morgan, and coincidentally, the first president of the Federal Reserve. Years later, Frank Vanderlip referred to this meeting as the actual conception of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System. This meeting was so secret at the time that not even the names of those who attended were mentioned to the servants who lived and worked on the island. The men who attended came on a late-night train, claiming to be on their way to a hunting expedition, but instead, these bankers met with Senator Nelson Aldrich to draft what would eventually become the Federal Reserve Act. This private meeting, attended by some of the most powerful men in America, was strategically designed to take control of our country's money supply and to achieve ultimate power in America. Meyer Amschid Rothschild, one of the most powerful European bankers of his time, stated it best when he said, "Permit me to issue and control the money of the nation, and I care not who makes its laws." On December 23rd, 1913, 2 days before Christmas, when most people in Congress were home with their families, the Federal Reserve Act was signed into law by President Woodrow Wilson. That single act, however small it may seem, transferred the control of our monetary system from our government into the hands of some of the wealthiest men in our country. Putting into law the Federal Reserve Act gave unlimited power to a few wealthy banking institutions in America. The Fed has the power to issue currency, manipulate interest rates, and run secret bailouts. Yet Congress and the President are not allowed full oversight over this powerful organization. The Federal Reserve enjoys a monopoly over the creation of our nation's money and credit, but for 100 years, they have never been completely transparent and accountable about it. And we don't have to look back too far from today to see what it looks like in real life. When testifying before Congress in 2009, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke refused to disclose which institutions receive trillions of dollars in these bailouts and loans, or give our representatives details about what deals were being made.
So my question to you is, will you tell the American people to whom you lent $2.2 trillion of their dollars? Will you tell us who got that money and what the terms are of those agreements?
Hundreds and hundreds of banks, any bank or that has access to the U.S. Federal Reserve's discount.
Will you tell us who they are?
No.
In an interview with Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, he makes the stunning assertion that conducting a full audit of the Federal Reserve, something never before done in its 100-year history, is a line that we don't want to cross. To be denied full transparency of these transactions after U.S. taxpayers contributed over $16 trillion to these bailouts and loans is unthinkable and unconstitutional. It is our right as American citizens to know where our money is being spent. It's very ironic that if you don't give the IRS full transparency with your finances, you go to jail. But if you're a private organization of elite bankers that controls the money supply of a country, you're free to do as you please without full oversight. This private organization is arrogant in the fact that the same accounting laws that apply to the rest of America do not apply to them.
There is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take.
Their control appears to be unlimited. And 2008 is the most recent example of how much power the Fed actually has on our country.
Many of us were told in private conversations that if we voted against this bill on Monday, that the sky would fall, the market would drop 2,000 or 3,000 points the first day, another couple thousand the second day, and a few members were even told that there would be martial law in America if we voted no. That's what I call fear-mongering.
The elite banking institutions took trillions of dollars worth of risk, and when they lost their bets, they threatened politicians to use taxpayer money to bail them out, or else we would face an Armageddon type of scenario. This historic change of power in America is again why many economists refer to it as the biggest robbery ever enacted on the American people.
Just another look at the Federal Reserve and the people who control our futures. And it's time that we held them accountable. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.